Welcome to part two of The Grave Talks, as we continue our conversation with Karen Hollis about the other side.
So when I found out, I said, really, Mark? Like, seriously, you took this headstone and you thought it was funny to drag it into the house? You know? He said, yeah, you know, I just thought it was kind of cool. So, you know, one of the first things we did was get rid of that.
Yeah.
And then, again, we have an ungrounded power source in the home. So in the kitchen, there was an ungrounded power source that ran underneath the bedroom where Mark's wife had, you know, been with him, a master bedroom. She had gotten cancer, by the way. Cancer ran in the family, but she had gotten cancer. Question remained as to whether the power source had anything to do with her catching cancer. But it certainly had something to do with the paranormal exploding in that household. The well to hell is actually in the basement. So when you go down to his basement area, there is an old well with a cover that's over it. And when I got into the basement, the feeling that I got was that there was a child there. And so I kept trying to communicate with this child, and I wasn't making a whole lot of progress because, again, a child is still a child, whether it's a ghost child or a human child. And so I did what was called direct channeling. So, in other words, I allowed this child to kind of overlay my energy, come in as a direct channel, and you heard the child's voice come out of my mouth. And that's where we got the story about why that child was there. That it had been waiting for its mother, that the mother had gotten sick, was supposed to come back. The mother had told the child to wait there. The child got sick and the child died and was just kind of staying there. So that's one entity within the house. Then, as the story goes, you have Corvo renting out rooms. You have a woman that comes in and rents. She's into Santeria voodoo, that kind of thing. She starts doing rituals, okay, in her area and in the attic area that was assigned to her for storage. And she puts up a symbol of what was called Papa Alegua. And Papa Alegua in the voodooing culture, he is the one who allows spirits through. So he sits at the crossroads, okay, between heaven and hell. He allows spirits to come through, to work for you, to do your bidding, whatever you want to call it. So when we went into the attic, we saw voodoo and symbols. And I called upon a Babalao that I know in New Britain, Connecticut, who came over. He's a priestess or priest of voodoo, to come in to take a look at the symbolism, verify that I was right about the symbolism, and to do kind of like a closure ceremony on that particular area. And so there's just multiple things going on with the Corvo household. Mm-hmm. Multiple. It was a fascinating segment.
When it comes to basically either drawing in an entity or expelling an entity, I'd love to get a better understanding of your take on it from something you had mentioned earlier, where we had touched on people saging, saying our fathers and things of that nature, which are ritualistic things that people do quite often to get rid of, or in their belief to get rid of an entity. Where is it that some of the rituals, which you had just described there in the voodoo culture of here's what they did to try and expel an entity, and there was also an area where an entity was drawn in. What's effective, what's not effective, and how do you determine which things are valid, I guess, for lack of a better term?
Well, I'm going to go back to my original premise, which is that if something really wants to stay, you can't really expel it. Or if you expel it, you're only going to expel it for a short period of time. But to answer your question, because I saw a voodooing symbol and I've studied symbology and all of that in great detail, excuse me, I wanted to bring somebody in who was an expert in it, and I figured, you know, worst case scenario, it would make the living feel better. So it would make Mr. Corvo feel better that we tried to shut down this particular portal or pathway or whatever you want to call it. You know, mm-hmm. we weren't sure if it was going to work or not.
Sure.
I just felt that when you have a ritualistic ceremony that opens something, mm-hmm. you probably should have a ritualistic ceremony within that religious denomination to close something. Okay. Did it work? For the most part, I think things calmed down. Okay, in that slave's quarters, in that area of the house. Why? Those entities were from the West Indies. Who knows what the religion was there, but it certainly probably wasn't Christianity at the time, I'm guessing. And, you know, perhaps they felt more at ease. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But the rituals that we do, Tony, are more for the living than they are for the dead.
Okay?
It's to make the living feel better about it. But I've never known, and I'm not dissing White Sage or the Native American way or anything like that, but you can run around all you want with sage and anything else. If something wants to be there and it has an attachment to either something, somebody, it will stay. So I'll give you another, for instance, okay? I have a haunted auction house in the Weathersfield area. And so people get attached to their things, furniture, jewelry, things they don't want to let go of, right? We all have things that are ours. Some people, when they die, they're never forced to go anywhere. You know, I think it's a Christian belief system that there's a heaven, a hell, and a purgatory, or whatever your belief system is.
Sure.
But, you know, if something's attached to something, it'll stay. So what works, in my opinion, I don't like mirrors. I feel that they are like the flip side to our world. So if there's an old antique mirror or there's a mirror in an area that where you're having a haunting, in my humble opinion, get rid of it. Because I think that somehow amps up the paranormal. I don't know why, but it seems to be a common denominator in all of these different segments that we've had. In the Sherman household, where we had the young man from the water tower, there was a mirror sitting right outside the master bedroom. It was an old mirror sitting next to an antique picture. I recommended they get rid of both of those things because I wasn't sure if the haunting was attached to it. In the Corvo household, he had, you know, a lot of antiques, a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's an owner's call as to whether they want to get rid of an antique mirror or not. But there was an antique mirror there as well. And it was stored in the basement, of course, near the well to hell.
Sure.
So, you know, there you have it.
You know, the well to hell, you know, also been referenced, you know, kind of as a portal as well. In this case, or really in any case, are portals relative to a specific location, like either something's going to trigger it and open it up because it's already there and it's something that activated it? Or can a portal really be created almost anywhere with the right with the right equipment, if you will?
You know, the short answer is I don't know. I mean, that's the honest answer. I think that portals are created accidentally by people who don't recognize that they're doing that, okay? Like, you know, when you buy an antique mirror and you put it up and you think, oh, that's kind of cool, you know, I like that there. And then, you know, the next thing you know, you find out that there's an entity that was attached to that because it was a possession of theirs, okay? Or perhaps, you know, you put that up and there happens to be an ungrounded power source and now you have, you know, haunting in your home. But I really don't know the answer to that question. I just know that there are common denominators in many of the hauntings that we, you know, that we investigate. One of those is alcohol, too.
Okay.
So, you know, many of the, there's another episode, Writers on Main. I forget the actual name of the episode, but, you know, restaurants notoriously haunted, and spirits love spirits. So liquor stores used to be called spirit shops. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that.
Okay.
So let me give you my theory on all of this.
Yeah.
And call me crazy, but this is my theory. So when you drink, okay, when you get drunk, your aura gets really, really big. And that's why we feel like free, okay, to, you know, we just feel free to be ourselves, or we feel, you know how you get when you get drunk, right?
Sure.
So, but your aura looks as if it's tattered, okay, to spirits that are around you. So if you had a spirit that was addicted in life, it wants to sup off of the alcohol or the energy that you're putting out if you're super drunk. So what happens is you've heard the phrase, when he drinks, he's not himself. So the eye color changes, the demeanor changes of the person. It's a temporary possession of the body. So that spirit can attach as a spirit attachment to you temporarily. It doesn't have permission to stay long term, okay? But it may feel, you know, sexual pleasure because you're drunk and you're with your partner. It may just feel free, or it's supping off the energy. When you start to sober up, what'll happen is that it doesn't have permission to stay by whatever you believe in, whether that's God, source, whatever your religious belief is. And so it's kind of squeezed out of the body, which is your shell and your aura. But now, okay, if it knows that you get drunk on a regular basis, it becomes an attachment. And now it's, you want to drink, Tony, don't you? You want to drink, don't you, Tony? Okay? And this is how we end up with serious alcoholism, in my opinion, is that we have spirits around us all the time. Some of them good, some of them bad, some of them manipulative, some of them trying to use us for their own pleasure. So, you know, it's an interesting theory, and we see a lot of homes where there's heavy drinking that's gone on, or there's been some kind of trauma or suicide or chaos or clutter or what have you. And this seems to be all part and parcel of, you know, the haunting.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Sure. Sure. No, it's a very interesting theory on that. With Mark's case here and the entities that were going on and the identification of what was called the well to hell, was he able to remove what was going on, the entities that had been causing the chaos within the properties?
He was able to ground that, what was going on in the kitchen. That helped tremendously, okay? Mm-hmm. He capped the well downstairs with cement, from what I understand, and that, I think, closed whatever, because there was a lot of water there, and water is a conductor, okay?
Sure.
So whatever was happening with that well, plus it was, you know, it's a hazard. So, you know, you have to take care of it anyway.
Sure.
But in any, you know, he had left it open because it had always been that way, whatever. But, you know, the point of the matter was, as I said to him, look, you know, in my humble opinion, I think it's a portal and I think you need to close it. So he did that. And then the other issue is people become obsessed, right? So if you know somebody is in your home that's not supposed to be there, and you're hearing voices or you're catching voices on a recorder, you start to get more and more paranoid. So, you know, he was getting to a point of paranoia where finally I had to sit him down to say, okay, listen, Mark, I know that you've heard these voices out loud. I know you've heard them on the recorder. We know you're not schizophrenic. We know you're an empath. We know that you have the ability to, you know, feel these things. But you're going to have to shut that off, because either you're driving the bus or the bus is driving you. And so this is what I mean when I say that spirits can get you into a state of fear and then feed off of that fear. So by teaching him how to meditate, ignore, don't turn that recorder on, go about your life, get on with it. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Either get on with it or sell the house. You got two choices.
Yeah.
By doing that, he was able to better manage himself. So part of dealing with a haunting is managing you. Okay, what are they going to do to you? Let's talk about this logically, Tony, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm afraid of alive people with guns. I'm not afraid of dead people.
Sure.
What are they going to do to me? Mm-hmm. Seriously. I mean, you know, and I think that the public in general doesn't put it in perspective sometimes. And I'm not trying to disrespect their fear, but I think you have to keep everything in perspective, journal what's happening in your environment, figure out when it's happening, what time is it happening, you know, what are the conditions outside? Is it humid? Is it raining? Is it sunny? Is it 2 o'clock in the morning? Is it 3 o'clock in the morning? Is it noon? You know, all of these things help somebody like myself and the people that do this research to figure out, okay, is there some kind of a pattern? Does that make sense?
Sure, sure.
And yeah, it's really interesting.
The more attention you give something, almost, you know, it's one of those principles where I think quite often we look at things and almost apply a whole different set of principles to the dead. When it's really, well, how would you treat a human being, too? The more attention you give something, the more likely it is to make itself known, to be present, to be there in your life.
If you poke it, yeah. Right? If somebody pokes you and you jump, yeah. What is it going to do? It's going to poke you again, right?
Exactly. And I think sometimes we almost put on sometimes magical powers onto the dead, where it's there just seems to be they're on the other side, but they still have about the same abilities they did when they were living. And if they realize there's attention being given, it will be shown back, you know, to you. If you don't want to give it the attention, it will likely not, you know, care that much to show you attention either. And I think sometimes those are some of those same principles that we need to live by. It's more logical than we give it credit for.
Right. And I think that what's interesting is that, and don't get me wrong, like, I love the ghost hunting shows. I think they're fabulous. I watch them myself. I look at you know, how these different shows are put together. But if you notice, there's always, like, a pattern to the shows, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, homeowner gets freaked out, homeowner calls ghost investigator, ghost investigator goes in and decides it's a demon,
yep.
Okay? Ghost investigator runs around with sage and or screaming the Our Father or some other whatever, okay? And then, you know, ghost goes away. It's not that simple. You know, that's like a formula, okay, of these shows. And what we've tried to do by being a part of a haunting and paranormal survivor and you know, God willing, maybe some shows in the future, if we can get enough fans to let these people know that we want to bring more sanity to all of this by being one of the teams that's on a regular basis, is what we're trying to really portray it the way it really is, which is, yep, sometimes bad stuff happens to good people. You got to keep your sanity about you, okay, because people are people, dead or alive. It's not necessarily a demon, because we don't have any evidence of that at this time. And, you know, let's figure out what you got to do. Either you have to remove yourself, or you have to broker a deal with it, or it will leave. But nobody's in charge of that except for the person that's haunting the house.
That wraps up part two of our interview with Karen Hollis about The Other Side. A big thank you to her for joining us on today's program. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.